Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome. What will the San Joaquin Valley look like in 20 years? Will years of chronic double-digit unemployment and low education levels be just a distant memory? Will the Valley's economy be lifted by the growth of high-tech jobs from software to clean energy? And will those workers commute from the Valley and cities like Hanford and Bakersfield and Fresno to L.A. and San Francisco on sleek, high-speed trains going over 200 miles an hour? On today's program, we look at both of these issues, high-tech jobs and high-speed rail. In the second half of the hour, we'll talk with local technology leaders who are aiming to establish the Valley as a center for software development and programming through a new competition that just might develop the next killer mobile app for your smartphone. But first, we revisit an issue that's seemingly growing in controversy by the day, the plan to build the first leg of California's proposed high-speed rail system through the Central Valley. Since our last program on the topic, objections by Valley farmers and residents have intensified, spilling over at boisterous public meetings. Later this evening, rail authority officials will solicit public comments on the project at the Kings County Fairgrounds. Earlier in May, the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst's Office issued a report that was highly critical of the project's management and the decision to build the first stretch of the system in the Valley. And just last week, the state Senate passed a bill to overhaul the Rail Authority and its board of directors. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Is high-speed rail just what California needs to boost the economy and create jobs? Will you ride the high-speed rail train, and at what cost? Or is the $43 billion plan the wrong project at the wrong time? Again, let us know what you think. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. Joining us in our studio right now, we have reporter Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee. He's been covering high-speed rail and the variety of issues that surround it for some time now. Tim, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
This is a project that has been years in the making. Prop 1A was passed by California voters back in 2008, authorized around $9 billion in state bonds to help fund a portion of the system. As we get closer to this process where ground is scheduled to be broken in 2012, as we get closer, the controversy seems to be building.
Yes, it is. Definitely. It's not slacking off at all.
One of the reasons that the Valley was chosen, we'll get into some of those as we go on today. One of the reasons that the Valley was chosen as the first leg of the system, as the backbone of the system, besides geography, was the fact that in California, a state that's often known to be big projects often face a good deal of criticism. Mm-hmm. Bay Area criticism on the peninsula was already developing early on.
Sure.
L.A., there were problems with building the system there. It was thought by California leaders that the Valley would be the easiest stretch to get public support for and start construction. Has that proven to be the case?
I think there may be some validity to that still, given the intensity of the opposition in the Bay Area and some of the concerns down in the Los Angeles area. The opposition here is intensifying, but I'm not necessarily sure that it is quite to the fever pitch that we've seen in some other areas of the state, although I think we're starting to catch up.
Now, let's bring our listeners up to date as far as where we are right now with the system and the process that is underway. Earlier this year, Rail Authority officials announced the first stretch of track, and it was from some rather remarkable locations or two endpoints, Borden in the north to Corcoran in
right.
the south.
Right.
Explain how we got there.
My understanding of how those points were chosen were that the federal government, when it decided to start allocating stimulus funds and rail funds to California, they wanted to get to an area with high unemployment to where the stimulus fund would actually do the most stimulating. That was earmarked for the Valley. The federal government essentially said, you will build in the Valley. Corcoran to Borden was sort of deemed the – not necessarily the logical choice but the easiest choice in terms of getting through one of the major areas, Fresno, where they need to build a station and then get a decent distance outside of the city to form the first piece from which they could build both south and north. I happen to grow up about 2 miles from Borden up in Madera County. So,
had you ever heard of Borden?
Oh, yes. Okay. Definitely. I was well aware of it. I did a history project when I was in elementary school on the Chinese railroad worker cemetery that is about the only remnant of the town that's there now. And it was interesting when I was listening into the announcement and they said Borden, I did a double take in my head and went, I know where that's at. Are they kidding?
Not exactly a major population center.
No.
that one would expect to hear.
No.
But that changed. The proposed route changed, or at least the endpoints of this first leg changed.
Exactly. As more money has come, I mean the initial announcement of Borden to Corcoran was made the formal decision was made by the High Speed Rail Authority in Sacramento in December. And at the end of December, toward the end of December, the federal government announced, hey, we've got more money for you. And so the southern leg started growing more toward Bakersfield. And as more federal money has been allocated to this to be matched by money from Prop 1A, the state funds, the endpoint has also grown north more toward the Chowchilla area. So ideally, the state would have liked to have received enough money to go all the way from Merced to Bakersfield with stations in Merced, Fresno, and Bakersfield, and perhaps the Hanford-Visalia area.
So right now we're looking at just south of Merced and just north of Bakersfield as the endpoints for this first.
Pretty much, yes. That's, you know, and how far it can go in either direction will really depend on the on what the environmental impacts reports show as the preferred route. And those are supposed to be out either late this month or early next month.
And that's what's starting to generate a lot of controversy, discussion in the community and people who start to say, wow, my house is in the proposed route or
exactly.
One of these proposed routes. And
exactly.
There's a lot of uncertainty out there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you just joined us on Quality of Life today, we're talking about the future of California's high-speed rail system with Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee. He's a reporter that covers these issues on a regular basis. Tim, one of the concerns that came up in the Legislative Analyst's Office report, which is really dealt a blow, but it was certainly very critical of the process as it's moved forward so far.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues was the decision to build in the Valley first.
Right.
This is something that the federal government mandated with the use of their funds, but
right.
the legislative analyst took a different view on that and was questioning whether that's a good idea.
Right. The legislative analyst essentially said, let's slow down. Let's, you know, not necessarily let the feds drive the train, essentially. You know, let's make sure that we're building this in the right place first, that we're using our money appropriately. And it was also very critical of the way the authority has been managing the project so far. So there was a lot of fodder for opponents on a lot of different fronts in the LAO's report.
Now, we're talking about in this first leg through the Valley about $5 billion in construction, give or take.
Close to six, actually,
six.
By now when you consider
costs
the –
costs go up that fast?
Well, when you consider the additional money that the feds keep throwing at
okay.
this thing in you know, several $100 million increments, and those are going to be matched by the state, I think we're up to around $5.5 to $5.75 billion now.
And there's other restrictions in regards to this federal money as well, correct? There's a timeline.
There is. The ultimate hard and fast timeline is that construction on the initial segment has to be completed by 2017. But a softer deadline that's in there is that the money has to be allocated for spending by September 2012. So that's the one that's really looming. And you know, that's been described by some as we have to start construction by September 2012. The authority will say we have to have our contracts set for the construction by September or October 2012. So either way, it's a deadline that's fast approaching.
And then there's this 2017 deadline for completion.
For completion of the construction, right.
Now, when we talk about completion of this project, we're not talking about completion of high-speed rail. We're talking about completion of the track.
We're talking about completion of building the track. And then what's interesting is that the money so far and the $43 billion price tag that the authority's been using for the project is for track construction only. It doesn't include electrification. It doesn't include signals. It doesn't include the trains themselves. It's simply let's build the track and then put something on it later.
Was that part of the LAO's criticism of this project in trying to make sure that if for some reason federal funding beyond what's already allocated doesn't arrive, that we have a system that has some use as a high-speed rail corridor?
I think that's part of what the LAO's, the Legislative Analyst Office, concern was. Also, the federal money comes with a requirement, too, that there be independent utility, what they call independent utility, that if nothing else is ever built, these tracks can be used for something. And the authority's indication is if everything fell apart, we got no more money, Amtrak could use these tracks and avoid having to share with the freight rails as they do now.
Let's go to the phones now and take a call from Frank on line two. Frank, you're on Quality of Life.
Hi there.
Yes, go right ahead.
I'm Frank Oliveira. I'm in Kings County. I represent Mel's Farms.
Mm-hmm. And your comments on high-speed rail?
Well, simply where they're constructing it here in Kings County is not where the voters thought it was going to be constructed. Everybody was under the impression that this would be built in a transportation corridor. And in our case, they're cutting across open farmland and dairies and ag support businesses. And, well, they're tearing up the county.
Are you satisfied with the way the project has been managed by High Speed Rail Authority so far?
No. No, we've attempted to engage them individually for about 12 months. And along that way, I found out that there were other groups that were trying to engage them in mitigation-type things, like don't drive over a dairy, don't drive over this part of a dairy, because you cause more damage. And most of what we discussed with them just never went anywhere, so we're kind of stuck with this project right now that's cutting across pretty much the largest areas in Kings County and hitting them in the most damaging way. And it's cutting across the northeast end of the county, which is, well, the best farm ground. That's why it's all planted in permanent crops like trees. They're cutting those properties up into smaller, non-productive, not efficient farm units.
Now, supporters of high-speed rail would say that regardless of the specific route that's chosen, there's always going to be winners and losers and always will be impacts associated with the route, whether it's traveling along Highway 99 and displacing the businesses that are along the freeway corridor and rail corridor there, or going through right through downtown Hanford, or going along this new route that bypasses the city of Hanford and goes through some of these more rural areas. Is this just a matter of that your group and the folks that you you represent happen to be in the path of this project, and regardless of where it goes, there would be such a group, or do you think that there's something larger, a larger problem?
Well, there is a larger problem. If this project was supposed to go down a transportation corridor, and if it was going along the edge of a transportation corridor, it would be causing less damage. Okay, if it was going along a transportation corridor like the proposition said it was going to, sold it to the voters as, then it wouldn't be even in Kings County, it would be a non-issue. But the rail has decided to run this through Kings County, and the methodology that they're using is economically damaging to the county, okay, and to the ag industry. We've discussed this matter with them. They know that people aren't happy here, but yet on May 5th, they reported to their board that they had mitigated most of the concerns down here pertaining to ag, the county, and the city. We know that that's not true. When they reported that to the board, they were asking permission to proceed with their project. So based on this misrepresentation or lie, which is it's a big deal, they got permission from their board to proceed. And see, what they told their board publicly at the May 5th meeting was not true.
Well, Frank, we thank you for your call today, and those are all very interesting questions. We actually devoted a program a few months ago to the issue of the impacts to agriculture of high-speed rail. So, Frank, we thank you very much for your call. And turning back to our guest in studio, Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee, that issue of where the rails go is a big one. The proposition 1A, when it was passed in 2008, was rather specific in terms of saying that the rails would go along existing transportation corridors, but that could mean the Santa Fe line, it could mean the Union Pacific line, it could mean any sort of corridor. At least that's what supporters say.
Right. The rail authority last week, after a number of Kings County folks, including Frank, spoke to the authority board last Thursday. I asked one of the representatives, you know, what about this argument about the transportation corridors? And they said that essentially the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which is the rail line that goes south out of Fresno through Hanford and down into Bakersfield, that this line very roughly follows, except for the swing east around Hanford through the farmland and some neighborhoods that Frank is talking about. Their assertion is that the Burlington Northern Santa Fe is a transportation corridor, that a transportation corridor need not necessarily mean strictly Interstate 5, Highway 99, or the rails that might run along them, that any major freight line such as Burlington Northern is also considered a transportation corridor.
We're talking about the sometimes messy process of building high-speed rail in the state of California. We'd like to know what you think. Is high-speed rail a project that is the wrong project, the wrong time, or is it just what California needs to provide quick, environmentally friendly transportation throughout the Golden State and to help transform the Valley's economy? You can let us know your thoughts, whatever side of the issue you may fall on. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. We'll be back in just a minute, take some more of your calls, and continue our discussion on quality of life on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We're talking about high-speed rail in the Golden State. You can call us with your comments, 559-275-8989, or toll-free, 800-224-8989. We'll get to some calls in just a moment. Before we do that, I want to turn back to our guest in studio, Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee. Tim, the numbers surrounding this project always seem to be changing. There have been a number of studies critical of the ridership projections that the Rail Authority issued some time ago. That has raised some concern because private investment in the project has yet to be forthcoming,
right.
And that's in large part attributed to lack of confidence or supposed lack of confidence in mm-hmm. those projections. And then the cost of the project itself seems to be under scrutiny. There's a number that's been touted by officials as a $43 billion project, but many say that number is actually a little higher.
Substantially higher, depending on who you listen to. There are estimates. There's a group called the California's Advocating Responsible Rail Design that has estimated through their analysis somewhere in the vicinity of $65 billion. There are other estimates that indicate that it could be closer to $100 billion. It really depends on who you ask and whose number you choose to use.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to Ed in Fresno. Ed, you're on Quality of Life.
Hi.
Hello, Ed.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes. Go right ahead.
I've got some thoughts. I was appointed by Governor Wilson to the original High-Speed Rail Authority. We did the original business plan that was submitted to the legislature in June of 2000. And just to speak to the B Riders' question regarding the ridership studies, when Cambridge and Associates was chosen as the contractor to do those studies, they were and still are the premier transportation analysts on the planet. And I don't know whether Mr. Sheehan had an opportunity to listen to the debate at the MTA meeting in Los Angeles last June's high-speed rail meeting. But the nuances in that argument between those two ridership studies were so subtle and small, it was almost like a battle of nerds gone wild. They're talking about how they determined dwell times in stations, headway times on rail lines, and how they came up with the Berkeley study versus the Cambridge study.
So, Ed, I take it your opinion is that the studies are still fairly sound? In your opinion?
I believe so, and okay. Even if you had been in that, you know, listened to that argument, or it wasn't really an argument, it was like colleagues discussing an issue, they both admitted, and especially the Berkeley folks admitted, that their interpretation was somewhat subjective and to how they looked at the numbers. It was not this totally, completely objective study. And so, again, it's so confusing, and people take statistics from either side and make them do what they want them to do. But I think the authority in good faith chose Cambridge Systematics to do that study. And I think generally that study is still proven to be right. As it relates to the authorities wanting to stay in existing transportation corridors, it was always the concept that the existing rail lines, the major rail lines, would be existing rail corridors. I mean, I-5 was eliminated early on. The ridership was not along I-5. I mean, the Valley ridership is important. Not important. It's imperative to make the business plan even begin to work. Well, and as far as the issue of foreign investors not wanting to invest or not feeling confident, I've had the blessing of being able to travel to many of the high-speed rail producers around the world, especially in Europe, been through heavy maintenance facilities, manufacturing facilities, and just last month there was a meeting in May in LA where 1,400 industry representatives showed up to find out about how they could be part of this high-speed rail line in California. If anything, what they're waiting for is the specifics of how they can be involved from an investment standpoint. It isn't from a lack of trust in the project.
Ed, we thank you very much for that call and for joining us on Quality of Life today. We'll now go back to the phones. We have another guest joining us, a critic of the project, and specifically its finances. William Grinley is the author of The Financial Risks of California's Proposed High-Speed Rail Project, a study that has been highly critical of the project thus far. Mr. Grinley, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
The project, as it's moving forward, as you see it right now, some people are philosophically opposed to high-speed rail in general, regardless of the particular proposal that's out in front of the state and is seeking funding at this time. Others say it's the wrong project, it's the good project, rather, but the wrong time, and we just don't have the money to pay for it. Where do you fall in that equation?
Sure. On the front cover of that report you referred to, we say we do not oppose high-speed rail in concept. The problem that we have is with the project as proposed in 2008 to the voters. There's a very important subsection, Section 2704, Subsection 8J of the underlying legislation, AB 3034, which says that the project cannot have an operating subsidy. Now, if you went to Transport 101, as I did at MIT, you learn all transit systems, all public transit systems in the world require subsidies. So the promise to the voters, and I'll quote, the users of the system will pay for the system, that was on the ballot in 2008, just didn't pass my smell test. That's where the opposition to its finances began.
Now, supporters of high-speed rail would say that there's some wiggle room there, that you know, what is exactly a subsidy, and there's been some discussion as far as what that means. Do you see that as being an issue in terms of what the voters approved?
I don't see it being much of an issue at all. Let me give you some quotes from, first, the director of high-speed rail at the International Union of Rails. Quote, "Only two routes in the world between Osaka and Tokyo and Paris and Lyon have broken even. Congressional Research Service says the same thing. July 10 World Bank report says the same thing. And actually last month, the AFL-CIO's trade union department said, quote, there's no high-speed passenger rail system in the world that operates without significant subsidies. Ask yourself this very simple question, Mr. Moore. Why did the private sector get out of the rail business? Because there's no profit in it. If there's no profit in it, the private sector's not coming back. The authority knew in June of 2008, 5 months before Proposition 1A, their study by the Infrastructure Management Group, their own consultants, told them that the private sector would not participate in this project without a revenue guarantee. Well, that was not told to the voters in November 2008. And then by 2009, when the authority submitted its business plan, there are five instances in that business plan in which they require a revenue guarantee. As you know, if you don't pay for the whole construction out of cash on the front end, you have to carry that over into the operating cost. The operating cost would have to service the debt. Servicing the debt would require a subsidy, because there is no way that, given the statistics and data from their own business plans, they can service that size debt even for a $43 billion project, much less the new number, $66
billion. So your concern, how does it extend to the construction of the system right now, the funding that's been provided by the federal government?
Sure.
One of the concerns that the Legislative Analyst's Office raised was, you have this money to build part of the system, you're going to wind up building in the valley from a rather rural area to a rather rural area, and it doesn't have the independent use as a high-speed corridor if further federal funding doesn't arrive. You're suggesting that private investment isn't going to come unless a subsidy is in some way approved, which voters have already ruled out. Where does that leave the project as it's funded right now? Do you see a risk of building a fraction of a project and then just being stuck with an unfinished rail line?
Yes, and the need for the federal grants, remember that's free money to the authority, need for federal grants was between $17 and $19 billion in the 2009 plan. If you scale that up from the $43 billion construction estimate, L.A., San Francisco, to the $67 billion, that means they now need $28 billion of free federal money. Let me tell you about the federal money. Federal money for high-speed rail at the moment, there was wiped off of the Department of Transport's fiscal year 2011 bill. The president, in his announcement in the State of the Union message, talking about connecting 80% of Americans with high-speed rail, put in a proposal to the Department of Transportation in early May of this year, requesting $37.6 billion of that. Unfortunately, he said it in a category called pay-go, which requires the administration to show where they're going to get from either new taxes or fees that $37.6 billion. No accompanying documentation showing that came along with that request from the OMB. That money, which would provide the money for the next 6 years to capitalize the project, is not going to be there. It means that by the end of fiscal year 2017, when President Obama has left office, if he wins re-election, which he's probably likely to do, he's going to have been gone when the next six-year allocation comes up. So do not count on any federal money of any size coming in over the next 6 years. Yes, we know that there's still $4.3 billion left in the pot that the DOT has from the stimulus funds of 2009. That money may be allocated. We've counted that into our financial model, and the model still requires $38 billion of private sector money. That money must be added on to the need for servicing the debt, which brings the servicing of the debt at that minimum up to somewhere around $6 billion a year. That's going to hit your state pretty hard because it doubles the long-term obligations of the state of California.
One of the arguments from the other side of the spectrum on this issue says, what are the costs of doing nothing? Or conversely, rebuilding the freeways, rebuilding expanding airports and things as the state grows and the need to service the transportation needs of the Golden State in the 21st century. People point out that our freeway system is also heavily subsidized beyond just the gas taxes that we all pay at the pump. How do you counter that argument?
It's not a problem. In fact, it may solve environmental problems. It may indeed cut foreign debt. It could also, to be very cynical, cure cancer. But there is this provision called Section 2704, subsection 8J, that says no operating subsidy. That's a hoop that they have to jump through. And it's very simple. It says you can't have an operating subsidy. You could have all those benefits, perhaps, at the end. I'm not questioning whether you could or not. But our basic point is that you have to be in conformance with that section of the law that authorizes the existence of the High-Speed Rail Authority before you can do anything else.
Well, Mr. Grindley, we thank you very much for joining us on our program today. Again, we're talking about high-speed rail, and we've just been joined by William Grindley, the author of a report called The Financial Risks of California's Proposed High-Speed Rail Project. Let's go to the phones now and talk to a caller from Clovis. Adolph, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Thank you.
Yes, your thoughts on high-speed rail?
I believe high-speed rail must be made. There's always been resistance to progress all through history. If we followed that, there wouldn't be Fulton Steamboat, there wouldn't be trains, there wouldn't be planes, there wouldn't be cars. I also think that you have to remember that when Eisenhower was president, he expanded our highway system and put people to work. And that would happen the same thing if they got the railroad going.
Well, Adolph, thank you very much for that call today, and we'd like to hear from you if you have thoughts on high-speed rail and its future for the Golden State, whether you think it's a good idea or a bad one. You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee joins us in our studio today. And Tim, sort of following up with Adolph's comment there in regards to the opposition for any project, this is California. When was the last time any big project of any sort of infrastructure sort was built in the Golden State without generating a lot of opposition and also a lot of lawsuits under things like the California Environmental Quality Act? Is there a concern among the people that you talk to that the potential for lawsuits and other issues that may come up, especially on the peninsula where there's even fiercer opposition than here in the valley, might derail the plans to break ground in the year 2012?
That's always been a concern of the High-Speed Rail Authority, is that litigation could, you know, freeze this thing in its tracks, you know, no pun intended necessarily. But litigation that extends things beyond the federal deadlines for the stimulus funds, could potentially jeopardize those funds, and they go back just like Florida's funds went back, Ohio's funds went back, and Wisconsin's funds went back. That is a huge concern.
Just have an email here from Evelyn, who sends this message. I'm in favor of high-speed rail. This would be very beneficial to the Valley. If we connect our cities, it would open up jobs and education opportunities for the people here. This would bring the wage down in the base cities and congestion of the highways in those areas. Those are some of the arguments that the supporters of the project bring up. Mm-hmm. The issue of jobs is certainly a very big one here in the Valley, both in construction and in the long-term support of the system through the rail maintenance facility. Mm-hmm. Is there any progress on the selection of that site? Bakersfield is in the running with a site that's been at least proposed to be donated by Paramount Farms.
Correct.
Fresno County has been very aggressive in proposing a site here in Fresno County, and there's also talk in Merced County of a site.
Right. Merced is trying very hard to pitch the former Castle Air Force Base as a maintenance yard. Fresno has its site on the southern end of the city, and of course, the farmland that Paramount Farms is proposing to donate. And that is really seen as sort of an economic golden goose by Valley officials. Wherever it lands, the anticipation is that will bring about 1,500 jobs at least. That the selection of that site, as I understand it, is going through its own environmental process along with the routes. Environmental impact reports for the routes will be out, sometime in the next month or so. And after that is decided, after they kind of get on the road to picking a route, then they will turn their attention more toward where this maintenance site may be. So I think the anticipation is that a site may be selected sometime early next year.
When it comes to actually looking at the impact of the valley, one of the things that I've heard people talk about is there will be commuters that now are living in Bakersfield, living in Fresno, living in Merced, and commuting to the Bay Area. But I've also heard high-speed rail compared more to the airline industry rather than a commuter rail type system. Is there any thought, has there been any further discussion from your knowledge as a reporter who covers this on a daily basis of looking into that a little further in terms of what it would really mean for the valley? Because if it's the cost of airfare, commensurate with the cost of airfare from Bakersfield to L.A. or Fresno to L.A., I think that might be different than if it was priced more on the commuter rail model that you have on BART in the Bay Area, for example.
Sure. I think from what I've read and from what we've reported over the 8 or so months that I've been covering this, the ticket prices are going to be much more comparable or competitive with airlines as opposed to a commuter rail. And that kind of addresses some of what Mr. Grindley was talking about. No one knows yet what the ticket prices are going to be, but the authorities' reports have indicated they want to be competitive with airlines. It's not going to be like, going down to the bus stop and dropping a buck in the fare box. And to the extent that that it may augment or supplant some air travel is also one of the things that's been talked about in we've not looked at it specifically here in Fresno, but it has been talked about other areas, San Francisco International, for instance.
Before we go, one last thought. There have been a lot of changes in the plan as of late, what they call value engineering, trying to make the project cheaper so they can build more.
Absolutely.
In Fresno, there was a plan to have an elevated rail running throughout most of the city. That's now off the table.
Yes.
Down in Kern County, a proposal change that had the rails going up through the Tehachapis to Palmdale now has the rail going through the Grapevine, which was ruled out a long time ago. Those changes, are there any others that are on the horizon or that we haven't talked about that are big changes?
Well, the aerial structure issue here in Fresno is also being looked at along, the entire valley section. Merced was initially talked about having an elevated station, elevated tracks through their downtown. That's at grade. Here in Fresno, tracks and station are now going to be at grade except for a short stretch where they need to go over 99 and head south. The Grapevine isn't officially on the table yet. They're taking another look at it. It was ruled out quite some time ago. That one is probably going to be a little bit of a fight because the cities in the Antelope Valley, Palmdale, which is where the proposals so far have been talking about taking the rails, those city officials are saying, hey, wait a minute. You ruled out the Grapevine a long time ago. Why are you even bother looking? And why they're bothering looking is because the anticipated cost dynamics are changing. And so they at least want to take a look and see if it might be cheaper to do it going over the Grapevine than going through Lancaster-Palmdale.
Well, again, Tim, it's a very interesting topic, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting this as the process moves forward. It's one of the biggest stories in California as we move forward, and the valley is right at the center of it. We've been talking about high-speed rail today. Our guest has been Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee, a reporter who has been covering high-speed rail on a daily basis. And, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and turn our focus from high-speed rail to high-tech jobs and the Valley's underground software industry. It employs a lot more people than you might first think, and there's a new competition on the horizon that is aiming to put the next great mobile app on your smartphone, developed right here in the Central Valley. It's coming up in just a moment on Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. Hello and welcome back to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. The Central Valley is known worldwide for growing food that's consumed across the globe. But while agriculture has been the main engine of the Valley's economy for decades, critics say the lack of economic diversification has hurt the Valley in the long run. Double-digit unemployment, a large pool of relatively low-educated, unskilled workers, those have been problems for the Valley for decades. Some have sought to remedy the situation with efforts to attract large-scale industrial companies to locate plants in the Valley, Boeing, Toyota. In most cases, those efforts have failed. In recent years, there's been an emphasis on entrepreneurship and focusing on growing startups and existing companies in the Valley in a few focus sectors, one of them being technology and software. And it might come as a surprise to many of our listeners, the Valley has a quite thriving software industry. In fact, there's a competition in its second year of operation that's just about to get underway that aims to help develop the next great mobile app, and it might be right from the Valley. Here to tell us more about the 59 Days of Code and the Valley's software industry, we have two guests, Travis Sheridan from the Central Valley Business Incubator and of 59 Days of Code. Travis, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Joe. Glad to be here.
And we also have Gustavo Cavalcanti, the board member, of the Central Valley Software Partnership and a founder of the CentralValley.net Users Group. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Joe.
Travis, first of all, tell us a little about 59 Days of Code. This is a competition that aims to bring the best and the brightest in Valley software developers to the surface and bring attention to what we have here in the Valley.
Right. Last year, we wanted to answer the question, is there talent in the Central Valley, software developers and engineers? Where are they if they're hiding in the Valley? Can we get them up to the surface? And we did. Last year, we were able to showcase about 12 to 15 different technologies that were put together by various teams of developers. And the premise behind 59 days, it's twofold. First of all, we ask, what can be accomplished in 59 days? Can a person build an application, web or mobile application, within 59 days? The second part of that is, can we build a community within 59 days of web and mobile developers? And we really were able to do that last year, and we're looking at doing it again this year. We're about 12 days away from the showcase event, which is June 21st and 22nd, where all of these competitors finally will be able to showcase and show off and allow the community to demonstrate and play with these new web and mobile applications.
Turning to Gustavo, a few weeks ago, Wired Magazine did a feature on the emerging technology hubs and actually had the Central Valley noted as one of those emerging hubs. When you talk to your peers outside of the Valley and you tell them what's going on here in Central California, is there some level, a barrier you have to overcome, a particular perception of the fact that the Valley may not have the type of software talent that might be in other parts of the country? What's that relationship like, trying to break through with the people in Silicon Valley who maybe think of Fresno, Bakersfield area as being
absolutely
backwards?
You're right. I do some public speaking, and I talk to people in these larger centers, and when they find out that we have a technology and software development community here, they are very surprised. We are perceived in this industry outside of the Valley as a, you know, as you said in the beginning, food growing area. You know, a lot of ag technology, and that in itself brings a lot of technology innovation. But on the software development arena, there is a perception that we are we're behind, and that's not true. Every time I speak to these people, I feel very fortunate to be in this area. Our cost of living and cost of housing here is not as nearly as expensive as they are there, and we don't. In compensation, salary, and the technology industry, we are very close to them, surprisingly.
Travis, you're in economic development as your day job, so to speak.
Right.
What does this mean for the future of the Valley? Is this something that we can focus on and try to grow? Obviously, Fresno and Merced and Bakersfield aren't going to become the next Silicon Valley with Google and Apple and Facebook.
I don't think they need to. I think one of the wonderful things about technology jobs in this sector and the folks that I know within that arena, a lot of them like Gustavo said, are still making the salaries that are comparable or at least competitive with the Bay Area, and they have the quality of life that they're able to enjoy here in the Central Valley. But the other thing is they generate a lot of their income, especially if they're freelancers or technologists for hire. They generate a lot of their income outside of the area. And so they have clients from the Bay Area, from across the U.S., if not across the globe. And so if we think about it from an economic development model, they're bringing outside dollars into the Valley and spending it locally. So it's not just getting a dollar circulating across a few hands here locally. It's bringing money in from the Bay Area, money in from Los Angeles, money in from Omaha into the Central Valley and being spent here. The other thing that I think that we're able to capitalize on as a economic development model is that as we grow our own talent here, sometimes we export that talent out. We just lost a very talented developer to San Francisco, got a great job up in the Bay Area, and it kind of broke my heart to see him go. Yet he is a huge ambassador and advocate for the Central Valley. So even though he may be 2.5 hours away now, he still has roots in the Central Valley and talks about it very fondly. I see him chatting about it on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. So sometimes we have to be willing to let some of our folks go so that they could be great advocates and ambassadors outside of our region.
Again, we'd like to know what you think. Is technology the future for the Valley's economy? Software development, high-tech jobs, what do we need to do to help foster that economy here in Central California? You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. Travis, I asked Gustavo earlier about the perception of the Valley's software industry, high-tech jobs outside of the area. What about the perception here in the Valley itself? Is that even maybe a bigger prejudice, a bigger hurdle to overcome? People are surprised. I'm surprised just in doing research for this story, the number of technology companies that are writing software and developing apps and doing these sorts of things right here in the Valley.
I think one of the reasons why we're so surprised and why it's a kind of the best kept secret is a lot of our technology companies that are headquartered here also don't necessarily generate a great percentage of their revenue from here. A lot of them have clients that are outside of the area. And technology is historically a behind-the-scenes function. If Decipher that creates wonderful surveying software and garner customer information, all of that, it's a research company. And so it's not flashy like maybe a Google is. However, it's providing a core service that a lot of these larger companies and online companies need. So I think from a perception standpoint, I'm going to blame the software companies as much as I blame the community for just not being out there and promoting more. Selfishly, I can say that we want as many of our local software companies engaged in 59 Days of Code as well, because it's their opportunity. I always look at it as a nice big career fair at the same time. It's their opportunity to get next to a lot of the talented developers and spend time finding out where the talent is, because these technology companies that do exist here have workforce needs. And so they are able to see firsthand the talent that exists within the region at 59 Days of Code.
Yeah, part of my passion is building the community. That's why I founded the CentralCalifornia.net users group 5 years ago. I'm part of the RJI, the Software Partnership, and the initiatives from the city. And I think a lot of the blame is on the lack of the community. We have to build that. That doesn't happen out of the vacuum. So it's amazing how when you talk to even developers about companies like Polestar, you know, this more than 25 years, the number one in its category in the country, Decipher, Bixley, you know, companies like that, people are amazed about what they do and their success.
We're talking about the future of the Valley's high-tech and software companies and high-tech and software jobs in the Valley. You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Let's go to the phones and talk to Celeste in Fresno. Welcome to Quality of Life.
Well, thank you very much. How are you?
Pretty good. I understand you work in software.
I do, and I was as surprised as anybody when I returned to Fresno about a little over 10 years ago to be closer to family from other employment I had in L.A. and happened to stumble into a technical writing job with, then it was Decade Software, and I'm with Famous Software now. Had no idea we had a software industry in a valley. You know, I had grown up here and wasn't even aware of it, and the company I'm currently working for actually deals with ag, so that's definitely related to what we've already got going in the Valley. And it's actually been in business for over 30 years, I mean, which you wouldn't even think of for a software company. That's a long time to be in business. And yet here it was, sort of sleeping in the background without people being aware that we even had it here. And I think the Valley is a great place to develop this as well as other industries. But I think we've got the same issues that other people have. My husband works for Kaiser. They have trouble recruiting doctors and that sort of thing, and it's because of, you know, the image that the Valley has outside. And so I think part of it is bringing more jobs here is going to be, you know, promoting Fresno in itself, as some of the guests have said already. Cost of living is great here. The quality of life actually is really good here, which I think we appreciate sometimes when we move back from another area. And I think we've got great potential.
Well, Celeste, thank you very much for that call. And it's certainly an interesting perspective and one that, you know, we've heard before. In fact, we did a program last week on the amount of unfilled jobs in particular highly skilled industries, jobs that go unfilled even with double-digit unemployment. Are you seeing that, Travis? Are you seeing that, Gustavo, in the demand? Is there demand right now for software programming jobs in the Valley? Or are there an excess of individuals with those skills looking for work?
Part of what I want to accomplish with the groups I'm involved in is to provide a platform for companies to find help and for developers to find jobs. And because of that, you know, almost every week I get a request for posting a job if I know somebody who's unemployed. And, you know, for the past 5 years, I only say no. I don't know anybody who's looking for a job. There are lots of job switching, you know, company switching, but I don't know anybody who's trying to find a job in Kent in the development software development arena.
Yeah, when we look at that, our unemployment, the high unemployment rate. I mean, those unemployment, I guess, numbers are not the same when you look at creative professionals and knowledge workers. A lot of those individuals are still gainfully employed, either as freelancers and making a healthy living as a freelancer, or as Gustavo said, job switching, moving from company to company. We've seen in the ag industry, there's still quite a bit of unemployment. However, the number of ag-related tech jobs is on the rise. You know, so there are tech jobs and opportunities that start filtering into what is at our core here, much like Famous Software does here in the Central Valley, and that is combining ag with technology. And those are still jobs that I won't say go unfilled, but they're a way to bring people to the Central Valley as long as we can tell our story the right way.
We're talking about software and high-tech jobs on Quality of Life today. We have a few more minutes left, so if you want to get in one last call, you can pick up the phone and dial 275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Also talk@kvpr.org. Travis Sheridan from the Central Valley Business Incubator and the 59 Days of Code is one of our studio guests, as well as Gustavo Cavalcanti, board member for the Central Valley Software Partnership. And Travis, I want to go back to the 59 Days of Code. This is something that is in its second year, as I understand it. Exactly what are we talking about? This is a one-day event? Is it a 60-day event?
Well, it started the clock kicked off April 24th, and that's when the developers we said ready, set, go, and they started working on their applications, web and mobile applications.
And they can develop anything they want?
Anything they want. We have things in the area of online resumes to form building machine mechanisms to referral sources for medical providers, a whole bandwidth of things. And then on June 21st and 22nd is when the clock expires. That means the 59-day countdown ends and it pencils down, just like in class, pencils down, hands to the side, and now they're showcasing their inventions or their applications. And so what we're doing is it's going to be in Clovis at the Veterans Memorial District. And now that it's a two-day event, we've actually turned it into a conference, which I'm sure Gustavo and the rest of the tech community would appreciate, having their own technology conference here in the Central Valley, where we have speakers and keynote speakers and workshops from folks like individuals from Amazon, Microsoft, Twilio, across the board. So we're getting a lot of outside folks that want to come in, as well as our own development community that is stepping up. And the great thing is it's a completely free conference. So the community can go and participate. Just go to 59daysofcode.com in order to get a little bit more information.
Is this something that the larger economic development community in the Valley is starting to pick up on, the potential for software and this type of grassroots development of tech jobs and tech entrepreneurs, or are they still on the radar of trying to get Toyota to build a new plant here to build the next Prius?
Well, I think it's a both and. I think we, through the incubator, we are focused on startup and early stage companies and continuing to launch successful companies. And the traditional economic development route is attraction and retention. So the better that we do in concert, and we work very closely with Steve Guile and the folks at the Fresno County EDC, the better job that we do at growing our own local businesses, the easier it is for them to go out and do a lot of the attraction. Because you can't attract a company here when they look around and see that we don't treat our entrepreneurs in a good fashion. And so we do see water, energy, and high technology as our three sectors at the incubator that we're trying to move forward. And that is very much in line with what the other economic development models are and initiatives are throughout the Valley.
Gustavo, any last thoughts on where this is headed? Do you see a bright future for technology jobs in the Valley, or are there looming clouds on the horizon?
No, absolutely. All the companies I interact with, they report they're growing. You know, you can see the old school type software development, doing innovative stuff too, like Celeste, who called from Famous, Argos Decade, who developed larger software, to smaller entrepreneurs like Red Swimmer, there, Tina Henson, you know, with the Business Bites launching soon, Plastic Jungle, Lori Seaborn building the Sparrow software, promising to be a huge hit. So, and there's a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of innovation here in this area, so I'm very excited about it.
Well, it certainly is an exciting topic, and we wish everyone the best in the competition, and excited about looking at those mobile apps when they come out in a few days. We've been talking about high tech and software jobs in the Valley on this last segment of Quality of Life for today. Our guests have been Travis Sheridan, the 59 Days of Code, and of the Central Valley Business Incubator, also Gustavo Cavalcanti, board member of the Central Valley Software Partnership. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
That's all for this edition of Quality of Life. My name is Joe Moore. For production and operations manager Don Weaver, for audio engineer Marv Allen, and producer Tracy Sharman, thanks for joining us. You can catch us online at kvpr.org, our podcast, streaming audio, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. It's all on kvpr.org. This is Valley Public Radio, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield. Thank you.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.